If time permits, we're going to try to cover chapters 8 and 9 tonight of 2 Corinthians, because those two chapters kind of go together and blend together, and then we'll like 10 through 13, and those three chapters go together. They close out the epistle with Paul basically making his final argument to the Corinthian brethren about his apostleship, his faithfulness, his preaching of the gospel. And that will bring us to a close in the book of Corinthians. And then, as we said, then we'll start our prison epistles, which will be Ephesians that we'll be looking at first, then Colossians, Philemon, and Philippians. And then that will lie as far as Paul's epistles, of course, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, that we'll have to finish. Those are books that he wrote after he was released from his 2-year prison sentence in Rome. And that will close out his epistles. And then we'll start the series of books that were written in between the book of Acts, the close of the book of Acts, and the destruction of Jerusalem in 87. We'll clip those epistles in next to get that chronological time span, and then that will leave, after the destruction of Jerusalem, that will leave 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and 1st and 2nd Peter, as well as Revelation. And that will bring us to a close as far, we'll work the Hebrew epistle in there. That will bring us to a close of the New Testament study. Let's remember that Saturday night, Larry Walker will be here, start a series of lessons that will follow through Sunday, and he will be conducting the Bible class and preaching twice on Sunday. Harold just made the statement, says, I figured out who he was. You've read a lot of his material in the bulletins the last couple of years, because Harold's put a lot of those articles that he wrote in our Sunday bulletins that you receive. You'll enjoy meeting him, and he's an excellent Bible student, and you'll enjoy that. So try to be with us as we kick that series out off on Saturday afternoon at 7 o'clock. Now notice, if you will, if you've had an opportunity to read chapters 8 and 9 of 2 Corinthians, it's going to be on the subject of benevolence. And basically, the benevolence is going to be for the poor saints at Jerusalem. Remember, if you will, when we were studying in the book of Acts, Agabus the prophet prophesied and said there was going to be a famine that took place, and it did. And there was a lot of need for benevolent help in the Jerusalem churches and those that are around that Judean area. And this is going to deal with the Corinthian church had basically committed to take up some money to send to the poor saints in Jerusalem. And it seems to be the case from looking at these two chapters that they had kind of, they had talked about it and not completed the gathering up of that money. So that will be what we'll be discussing. Notice, if you will, as it begins verse 1 of chapter 8, moreover, brethren, we do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia. Anybody remember who the churches of Macedonia would have been? One of them would have been Philippi. One of them would have been Berea. And of course, one that we talked about would be Thessalonica. There may have been more, but those three are specifically mentioned that Paul dealt with on his missionary journeys. So when he's talking about Macedonia, he's talking about more than likely those three congregations. Notice what he goes on to say. How that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. Now, what does that tell us about these congregations in Macedonia? What does it sound like? We know they're liberal in their giving and their benevolent mindset, but what else does it tell us about?
They have a great affliction.
Okay.
They're still in a deep poverty. They're not rich in the liberality.
All right. Now, if you really stop and think about and you look at the historical background of this particular area, the Macedonian area, one of the things that you'll notice from a historical background is that that particular area had gone through three civil wars. So they had just finished going through three civil wars in the past 150 years. Then you put on top of that the persecution that was being meted out on those three congregations because they were Christians. So, if we just kind of really stop and think about it, we can see why they would be in deep poverty. And you can see why they would not be blessed living in areas that was more profitable to live in than others. But yet, there was something about them that created in them a desire to be benevolent-minded and to dig down and give, as Paul would later say, beyond their means. You know, if you'll remember when we were studying the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we read about the widow and her mite, what she gave. I think you could kind of put these congregations into that type of background. He goes on to say, for to their power I bear record, yea, and beyond their power they were willing of themselves, praying us with much entreaty that we would receive the gift and take upon us the fellowship of the ministering of the saints. I think what Paul was saying here is that in reality they had given much more than they could financially afford to as individual Christians. And when something was said in regards to it, their prayer was, God has blessed us, and we want you to take this money to the churches at Jerusalem. And it says, praying with much entreaty that we should receive the gift and take upon us the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. Now, when we think about fellowship, what do we normally think about? David's going next door to the building. And we do. But that's a really superficial thought process when you think about fellowship. Because when you're talking about the word fellowship, you're talking about joint participation. So these congregations in Macedonia, though they were in great affliction and in deep poverty, they had really shown their love and their compassion and their willingness to joint participate with the rest of the churches in the area to help participate with relieving the poor saints at Jerusalem. So you get a beautiful illustration of what true fellowship really is. And though we sit down and we eat together and we grow closer, that is good. But when you're really talking about true fellowship, it includes far more than just a meal, a common meal. Because one can have a common meal and not have true fellowship. The Corinthian church proved that. Because they came with their fellowship meals and some of them were left out. And some were looked over. So, you know, just because you bring a meal doesn't necessarily mean that you're joint participating as a congregation. Every individual is working together. And that you're looking out for the benevolent aspects, and not necessarily benevolent aspects, but working together in ministry of preaching the truth. There's a lot of ways that you can joint participate. You know, it's not uncommon for smaller congregations to work together to support a gospel preacher somewhere so that the ministry might be carried out in another location. Notice, if you will, he goes on to say this, and this they did, not as we hoped, but first gave their own selves to the Lord and unto us by the will of God. Now, there's a true way to teach and to promote spiritual growth in any congregation, that you encourage each individual person to give of themselves as much as they can give of their time, their talent, and their energy. Yes, David?
What does it mean, not as we'd hoped?
I think what he was saying is that we expected a far smaller participation from them based on their background.
Yeah, I would say above and beyond what they expected.
Yes, they gave far more than they were ever expected to do. And we see that quite often. We see people in the Lord's church that give far more of themselves as individuals than many others do, and some even give more than they themselves can afford financially, and they give more in work ethic around the church to see that things are done and that worship is conducted and that the gospel is preached. So I think that's what he's talking about here when he says that day. Inasmuch that we desire Titus that as he had begun, so he would also finish in you the same grace. Now he brings Titus into the picture. And he's already talked about these Macedonian congregations, and Titus is now back. And Titus has been working with the Corinthian church, and what Paul was saying was, now, you know, Titus has been with you, and you said that you were going to have your contribution ready, and it's really not together yet. And we dare not come to Corinth with these churches that has already taken up their money and have assigned men to go all the way to Jerusalem to deliver it. And we get to Corinth and you've got to get yours gathered together. And he's going to determine and talk about why that will not look good to these other congregations. It says in verse 7, therefore, as you abound in everything, in faith and utterance and knowledge and in all diligence and in your love to us, see that you abound in this grace. What do you think he's saying right here? Yeah, he's saying, look, you have been blessed and blessed and blessed with spiritual gifts, and you're living in Corinth, which is one of the best places in the universe to earn wages and make a living. Don't drag your feet. You know, do what you said you was going to do. Exercise this grace. Because it is a grace of God to be able to financially help, not only monetarily, but it's a grace of God to be able to give personally, whether it be your time, talent, or money. He went on to say in verse 9, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that you through his poverty might be rich. Now, how do you think he's going? How does he mean that because of his poverty, talking about the Lord's poverty, they could become rich?
He gave up everything.
He gave up his life. He left heaven and came here, shed his blood, gave his life, so that they could be rich spiritually. Remember, if you will, we talked about Philippians 2 when Paul told the Philippian church, let this mind be in you. You be thinking about what the Lord did and how He suffered. And, one day, every knee is going to bow and acknowledge Him as the Messiah. He goes on to say in verse 10, and herein I give advice, for this is expedient for you, who have begun before, not only to do, but also to be followed a year ago. Now, what does that tell us?
They planned to do it a year ago.
Yeah, you committed to this work a year ago. Go ahead and do it. Perform, he says, the doing of it. In other words, get it together. If there be first a willing mind, it is accepted according to that a man hath, not according to what he hath not. For I mean not that other men be eased and you burdened, but by an equality that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want, that their abundance also may be a supply for your want, that there may be equality. As it is written, he that had gathered much had nothing over. He that gathered little had no lack. This is a statement here, verse 15, from way back in Exodus, the 16th chapter, where Moses was talking to the children of Israel. But he goes on to say, but thanks be to God, which put the same earnest care into the heart of Titus for you. For indeed he accepted the exhortation, but being more forward of his own accord, he went unto you, and we have sent with him the brother, whose praise is in the gospel throughout all the churches. I wish I could tell you who the brother was, but I don't know. But we know that he went with Titus. And he's working with the church in Corinth, encouraging them to get their offering together, so that when Paul and the rest of the men that represent the other churches that have given can make their way off to Jerusalem and get that money to the poor saints there. Some think this man was Luke. If you remember when we were studying on Paul's missionary journeys, Paul left Luke back in that Macedonian area, and some think he stayed there some 5 to 6 years, and that could possibly be him that they're referring to here, but we don't know. We just wonder, and that's about all we could do. It says, not that only, but who also chosen of the churches to travel with us with this grace, which is administered by us to the glory of the same Lord, and declaration of your ready mind. Now, there would probably be a number of reasons why. We don't know exactly how many churches, Gentile churches, had taken up individual contributions. And it seems to me that they would assign either one or two men to travel with Paul. And then, as they made each church, the number of men would build into a sizable number, and you just imagine how many men was in that party by the time they got to Jerusalem. And it would do a number of things. It would probably serve as protection. You just stop and think. They were traveling, sleeping out in the open from time to time. There would be robbers there, so that would help prevent something like that taking place. But it would also prove to the churches that gave the money that they sent two men, and the two men could come back and report, we got the money exactly where it was supposed to be, and it's in the hands of those that need it. So it also served as a transparency for people to know that Paul and the other men did exactly what they said they were going to do. They got the money to its appointed places. Now notice, if you will, you close out in 24, it says, wherefore show you to them and before the churches the proof of your love and of our boasting on your behalf. In other words, Paul is saying, you know, get it together and get it ready. For as touching the ministry of the saints, it is superfluous of me to write unto you, for I know the forwardness of your mind, for which I boast of you to them of Macedonia, that Archaea was ready a year ago, and your zeal hath provoked very many. So what Paul is doing is, in a very nice way, kind of jacking them up. And says, you have been a great help. You made that commitment a year ago. It's encouraged others all through the country, other congregations, to say, I want to be a part of that work. And they've given their money, and we've got it. We're coming to get yours. And we don't want to see you have to gather it up. And when you really stop and think about the contribution on the Lord's Day, it is for that purpose, that there be no gatherings when something comes up and there needs to be something spent on behalf of the congregation to do a benevolent deed or to do a mission of preaching the gospel somewhere. You got it. You've given it, you laid it up, and you can willingly give it to someone that is in need or someone that needs it financially to preach the gospel at another location. So that would be the purpose behind the commandment to lay by in store on the first day of the week. And not only that, to do it in the right manner, just like Paul is telling the Corinthians, we know that you really meant sincerely to have this money together, and just reminding you we're on our way and we want it to be there when we get there. It says, less happily in verse 4, if they of Macedonia come with me and find you unprepared, we should be ashamed in this same confident boasting. Therefore, I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren that they would go before unto you and make up beforehand your bounty, whereunto you had noticed before, that the same might be ready as a matter of bounty and not as of covetous. So he's laying down some background information here. David, how much time we got? Looks like we're running pretty close.
I think we've got about 5 minutes or 7 minutes.
We're getting to a section now about verse 12, 13. If you would like to spend some time, this is a section of Scripture where the Lord's body has divided over how you deal with benevolence. And if you would like to look at, during this section, some reasons why there are congregations that are out of fellowship with us, one in this town, because of the issue of benevolence. Would you like to look at a study on that to kind of see why? If we do, why don't we take just kind of stop right here? And then next Wednesday night, we'll spend the entire session talking about that. Back in the 50s and 60s, the church split over the orphan's home. And that was getting to be a very popular and a needful thing, to have orphan's homes to take care of some orphan children. And it split the church down the middle. And the church at Eastside would be one of those congregations. And they will not fellowship us. They think we're unfaithful brothers and sisters in Christ. And there's really no need for that. But what the real central theme of it is that those brethren believe that the contribution should be used for saints only. And that you cannot take any money out of the church treasury and give to anyone other than a Christian. And they split fellowship over that. And so it goes much deeper than just the orphan's home, because when you're thinking about the orphan's home, who are you helping in an orphan's home? In most cases, non-Christians. Why? Because they're too young. And you run across some that are now, but the real hub of the matter is the benevolence section. And this is a good place to stop and really look at the subject of benevolence and what the church can do benevolently and what it can't do, and how the treasury is to be handled and not. And it's sad that these two congregations in this town cannot fellowship one another, might never be able to worship under the same roof, but there's no reason why we couldn't go to their meetings and they couldn't come to ours and there be fellowship in that avenue. Because they're really honestly not that much difference between this congregation and that one in the way we handle the treasury. Of course, there are other issues, and we'll talk about that some. The major emphasis, I think, that distinguishes between us and them is that we'll eat over there once a month in that building, and they don't think that you should do that. Because they don't think you have any authority to use the money for anything other than doing mission work and benevolent work among Christians and among saints. And let me give you a few verses to write down for that study. Write down Acts 2, 41 through 45. Acts 4. Acts 2, 41 through 45. Acts 4, 31 through 35. Acts 6, 1 through 4. Acts 11, 27 through 30. Romans 15, 25. 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 through 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 1 through 5. And 1 Timothy 5, and at verse 16. These are scriptures that they use to prove that you cannot help anybody but a Christian out of the church treasury. And once you read these scriptures, you're going to notice that most all of these scriptures are scriptures to where, just like right here, 8 and 9, 2 Corinthians. What are they doing? They're taking up money to go where?
Jerusalem.
To Jerusalem. For what purpose? To help the poor saints. And they'll go through all of these verses and say, you see, they help saints, 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 saints. And their conclusion is, you can only help saints only. And when you talk about Galatians 6:10 that you are all familiar with, and you talk about James 1:27 where it says pure religion and undefiled before the Father exists to visit the fathers and widows in their afflictions keep oneself unspotted from the world, then they'll say, but that is an individual passage. It is strictly to the individual. And that the individual is to help all people, not the church. So those are some things to think about and read between now and next Wednesday night. And it'll be, I think, an interesting study and an interesting discussion. And at least if you have an opportunity to one day talk to them, you'll have a background and understand kind of where they're coming from, where their arguments will be made to support their thinking on